important questions that Amit's been asking us. In this talk, I'm just going to give broad strokes, absolutely no technical detail, because for the mathematicians amongst you here, you know, you'll find that the mathematics is, you know, relatively easy, and I can give you references. But I just wanted to identify areas that, you know, in discussions with Amit, turned out to be areas that medical researchers and clinicians would be interested in. So, you know, I got them in small letters. I should have put them in big names. So, you know, this is work with Amit. Pino Tenti, who everybody at Waterloo knows very well, has been quite central to a lot of this. Mohammed Cohen Bell, who would have given this talk, but he disappeared to Boston. and Rudy Gunawan, Jibin Powertil, Sean Speciali, and Kathleen Wilkie more recently. Now, what I'm going to do is, you know, when I discuss a lot of the areas, I'll just point you in the direction of the poster out there that each of these guys have done. Right? So let me start off by giving you a few bits of information. You know, first, which is from a World Health Organization document, which says that cancer is now poised to overtake heart disease as the major cause of premature death in the Western world. The Imperial Cancer Research Fund in the UK in 1994 gave statistics of something like 1 in 3 people will be affected by cancer in Britain during their lifetimes. The Australian Institute of Health and Welfare in 1999 said that 1 in 3 men and 1 in 4 women will be affected by the age of 75 by some form of cancer. Of course, the IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer in North America, which says exactly the same thing, that it's poised to become one of the major diseases in North America as well. Well, the study of cancer is not really new. You know, it dates way back to antiquity. And you know, if you sort of, and now you have Google, you know, you can get on there and see, you know, 3,500 years ago was the first documentation by the Egyptians of the New Kingdom, medical practitioners of the struggle with the disease. And if you look at ancient texts of Greece and Rome, apparently early physicians there were fully aware of cancer. They were capable of making correct diagnoses and actually had, to some degree, some forms of effective treatment. Aetius of Amida, who was a physician in the Byzantine courts, lived 527 to 565, he actually has the first sort of documented accounts of breast cancer operations, where he states that the knife should cut healthy tissue around the tumor, and a cauterizing iron should staunch the blood. Now, Aetius of Amida, it turns out, you know, actually also wrote a medical encyclopedia, I think of 19 volumes. And amongst other claims to fame, he also had three methods of contraception involving pomegranate, and one of them he claimed was completely infallible. You know, but anyway, the study of tumor growth and say treatment strategies, development of anti-cancer therapies, is clearly, you know, a worthwhile endeavor, not just from the health perspective and helping people, but I think, you know, improving quality of life, life expectancy, but also it has you know, significant impact on a society in terms of economic and social benefits. Okay, so let me start off with the first thing that we looked at that Amit actually asked us to look at, and that was essentially this paper by Hahnfeld, Folkman, and Hlatke, which was called Minimizing Long-Term Burden, and it's called The Logic of Metronomic Chemotherapeutic Dosing and its Anti-Angiogenic Basis. Metronomic for mathematicians is just periodic. Okay, you know, there's nothing spectacular, but it's just. Folkman actually, in earlier documents, when he, you know, sort of credited with the idea of angiogenesis, credits the original idea to Bob Kerbel, who's at Sunnybrook Hospital here in Toronto, and he has a recent article in the National Reviews of Cancer on the anti-angiogenic basis of metronomic chemotherapy. You know, Rudy Gunawan's master's thesis, you know, of course, is a definitive piece of mathematical analysis of metronomic chemotherapeutic cancer treatments. essentially, I'm sure a lot of you, probably already know, but Folkman, from way back, has shown that, if you take a tumor of, say, 1 millimeter or 2 millimeter diameter in vitro, it's absolutely impossible. Well, he has a sort of prize, for all students and any of his co-workers, saying that if you can grow that in vitro tumor to more than 2 millimeters, you get an expenses-paid holiday to Florida with a, five-star hotel. So, in other words, the in vitro information sort of basically shows that the growth of a tumor is diffusion-limited, right? And it won't grow past a certain diameter just through the diffusion of nutrients. And, Folkman's major contribution is to show how within the body the epithelial cells are sort of attracted and form a vasculature which then forms within the tumor, and it's at this stage that you get the sort of explosive growth that takes place. So we looked at this problem, and basically the Rudy's work took the model that Hahnfeld, Folkman, and Hlatke had sort of proposed. Carl's somewhere in, we were sort of agonized for a while about, because Carl has almost the same type of approach, but with maybe more sensible modeling. We weren't sure, but, he wasn't referenced in that paper, and we unfortunately took the Hahnfeld Folkman model. And so if there are queries about, why this happens, I think we sort of can't really justify all the things in these compartments. So you're modeling the tumor essentially as two families of cells, the normal cells and the cancer cells. Okay, it's a little bit simplistic. And you're saying that from the normal cell compartment, you get sort of a transition to cancerous cells and vice versa. Okay. Proliferation you get in the normal cells, but in this model they also have proliferation within the cancerous cells. So we took this model, and you can write down a simple 2x2 system, as we've written there, where sort of, the gamma 1 is the transition rate of P cells to Q cells, gamma 2 is the transition the other way around, Q cells to P cells. Then you've got C of T, which is the chemotherapy concentration. So this can be analyzed, and Rudy's done that, using Laplace transforms, and produced a slightly improved version of this model. And that's in his thesis and also in the poster outside. Future work he's pursuing is extension of these models to three compartments. Did you talk about it on the poster there, Rudy? Yeah. And as well as fitting parameters empirically to actual data, which I think is sort of crucial in all this work, as Carl's stuff shows. Okay, so that was the initial sort of modeling foray we took. And then Amit asked us to look at this question of sequencing of surgery and chemotherapy. Clinically, it's been a sort of long-held belief that the way you treat ovarian cancer is to go in and do surgery and do optimal debulking. After that, you do a combination chemotherapy with something like paclitaxel and carboplatin. However, Amit put up about 5 studies. He gave me those 2 studies there, which appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, the if and when of surgical debulking for ovarian carcinoma and secondary surgical cytoreduction for advanced ovarian carcinoma. Both appeared in the same journal. And there they found that it was actually significantly better to do upfront neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So you do chemotherapy first, then followed by surgery, and then more chemotherapy. So we sort of went back to the literature again, and Carl's work in 97, where he presented a mathematical model and used it to study breast and ovarian cancer treatment with paclitaxel. In that model, he could study varying treatment period, drug infusion time, dose strength. And these 2 papers which he mentioned, where he used sort of optimal control techniques to study competing chemotherapeutic cell kill strategies. So we actually focused on the very simple modeling equations that he had there, and that's basically what we started off with. Okay. So essentially, you have a single ODE there. And N is the total number of tumor cells. Okay. And then you get the rate of change of that is equal to, you've got three terms on the right-hand side there. The function F gives you the tumor cell growth dynamic. So generally that would be exponential growth, generalized logistic, Gompertzian growth, any of those things you could put in there. G, the function G, really includes all the pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic effects of the drug. And we just took off the last term, which basically corresponds to surgical intervention. So at time T equals TS, or in other words, you know, when this is sort of like the delta function, but it's just one if you're at T equals zero. So at that point, you take out a fixed proportion of the cancer cells. And we've sort of analyzed, let's say, using Gompertzian growth, okay, and then use the same cell kill strategies that Carl had studied in the Carl and René Pfister had studied in the optimal control thing. So we use the Skipper log kill, the Norton-Simon hypothesis, or the Emacs cell kill. Now I'm not sure whether that Emacs has any clinical application, but anyway, we looked at all those. And so essentially, it's a very simple problem to study, right? You can actually write down for Gompertzian growth and these simple things, exact analytic solutions. But essentially, suppose your tumor grows to a certain size, at a fixed time T chemo, I've called it there, you sort of administer chemotherapy and then wait till another fixed time. And at that point, you do surgery and then work out what the total tumor mass you have left is. Or you go the other way. You start at the corresponding chemotherapy time. You carry out surgery, and then you administer chemotherapy, and at the same time, look at the total tumor mass. And in this case, it's sort of very easy to analyze. I mean, of course, if the growth dynamics is exponential, then you actually, it's easy to see that you actually get no difference between doing chemo first and surgery, or surgery and then chemo. However, in the case of Gompertzian growth, the log kill actually gives a reverse effect. So it actually tells you that doing chemo first and then surgery, you actually do better than surgery followed by chemotherapy. And the Norton-Simon hypothesis, depending on how you vary your parameters, you can change things, but you get a similar, you get the other way around. You know, thinking about it, it's sort of, you know, intuitively plausible because, you know, in the log kill case, you know, your log kill is really sort of proportional to the size of the tumor. It's bigger the bigger the tumor is. So you might expect that doing chemo there with the log kill hypothesis would give you better results. And then for the Norton-Simon hypothesis, where you're looking at the kill being proportional to the rate of change, dN dt, as you're in the case of Gompertzian growth, you know, as you get near the carrying capacity, dN by dt is going to slow down. So in that case, you might expect that surgery first followed by chemotherapy would be better. The Emacs case, you can't really sort of tackle analytically, and so you do some numerics, but there you have to worry about parameter values much more. Okay, so, you know, looking at these models, you know, mathematically, you know, I guess, mathematically speaking, you know, you'd say that models of this type are naive and oversimplified compared to various other models. For example, reaction diffusion models that Kristen used and various other things in the current mathematical and medical literature. But if you're a mathematician and, you know, say you go to the literature to see what's the sort of routine model that's used, you'll find that the routine model used by experimental biologists and clinicians are based, you know, all on sort of simple ODE models. These models are really the basis of applied medical modeling in practice. Okay, and then, you know, moreover, what you find is that for these simplistic models, if you look in the literature, it's the fitting of the parameters to data that forms the crux of all the discussions. Okay, So ODE models of this kind, really, what are their aims? They're really trying to capture key features using a minimum number of parameters. And equally importantly, what they try to do is to, by judicious choice, eliminate peripheral features that you don't want to capture. What you find also is that the really more sophisticated models that appear in the literature, quite often are just a marginal extension of some simple ODE model. Okay, they don't really give you too much more information. So in my opinion, I don't know whether you agree, some of the most some of the hardest challenges in this area are really trying to fit pretty much as Carl said, accurate parameter values to models that are mathematically simple yet have a broad range of applicability. Of course, as a mathematician, generalization, is always beckoning, and you sort of feel like you should maybe generalize the model. But I think, the payoff in actually generalizing is minimal. And, there are a lot of plausible possibilities that are just vaguely tied to actual observation and data, so much so that there isn't one generalized model that's gained really any widespread acceptance in the medical community. So, now, having said that, of course, when Kristen talked last year, was it last year or the last Math Oncology, Amit and I both sort of thought, ovarian tumors appear to possibly consist of motile cells that can migrate as well as proliferate. And so, spatial aspects, we thought, maybe should be incorporated. And so, following from Kristen's work, actually lots of other works, but I just put two papers there, we thought of, the obvious thing would be to try and model this as a reaction diffusion type equation. And here you have C, which is the cell density, so the rate of change of cell density. In her work, she's looking at gliomas, so you have a diffusion coefficient that sort of is going to be different in gray and white matter. Here we just take a constant diffusion coefficient. There's a net proliferation rate, and chemotherapy effect, again, modeled the same way as we did in the ODE type problem. In this case, because we didn't know what, we just looked at two simple, log kill or Emax. Basically it was because we couldn't really see how to translate the Norton-Simon hypothesis into this type of setting. So now, if you use that, again, Jibin's poster out there sort of looks a little bit at that. How we've incorporated surgery into that model is that surgery, instantaneously removes a fixed fraction of tumor cells within a defined area. So that effectively just means that you reset your initial condition to zero at time of resection when you do the surgery, T equals TS. So you're assuming that all tumor cells in a certain surgical radius are just removed at a certain time. Okay. Right, so now let me... So that's another aspect we've looked at. And the last one, which probably about a month or so ago, Amit sort of sent me this paper, we haven't made a lot of headway with yet, but this is the last thing that he talked about, which was intraperitoneal versus intravenous. In this case, the classical manner of administering these sort of cisplatin and cyclophosphamide is for ovarian cancer is intravenously. However, those studies that he showed, and the large prospective phase 3 study, actually showed that you get a significant survival advantage by actually administering this drug intraperitoneally. Of course, there have always been some sort of pharmacokinetic problems associated with intraperitoneal dosing, and that's one, poor tumor penetration by the drug, and another problem that people have highlighted is incomplete irrigation of serosal surfaces, that surface of covering organs, by the drug-containing solution. So here's the classical way that, in the medical literature you see this model. There's a two-compartment model where you have a peritoneal cavity. You've got this peritoneal membrane, and then the outside is the body compartment. And so you get... gamma 1, I put drug-dependent mass transfer coefficient. You get transfer of fluids across both ways. VP would be the volume of peritoneal cavity, and CP is the free drug concentration in the peritoneal fluid. And the corresponding thing, free drug concentration in blood you can measure, and I'm not sure how they measure volume of distribution of drug in the body, but apparently those figures people can get their hands on. And so this lumped model perspective has really provided a unifying paradigm for the design of numerous clinical, preclinical trials. Now, with this sort of study, there have been attempts to try to model this, you know, not in such a lump parameter, two-compartment model, but, you know, my perspective on this is that it's still a compartment model, and you're going to miss a lot of the information. So there are people have tried now introducing more compartments. So you have the peritoneal cavity, liver, hollow viscera, parietal tissues, and then the body compartment, and then you have transfer. So in the literature, they call this some sort of distributed, you know, model. And however, my initial feeling here is that this is, you know, sort of very related to the type of work that Sean's been looking at on microvascular physiology and transport through tissue. And I think from our perspective, this may be the best way to try, although this is a more fundamental and sort of longer term project, of trying to model this process. Because you've got the peritoneal a membrane, you've got transfer across there. Or even for the intravenous case, I think the sort of work Sean's doing actually tells you something about transfer of drugs across vessels, microvessels within the tumor. So I think in the long term, much as I've been saying that compartment or ODE models are what's there in the literature, I think this continuum mechanics approach will actually reap benefits in the long run once we work out exactly what to do. Let me just, so that's a problem that we are looking at. And I just thought, as a final thing, I'd look at what I think of future directions which would be of direct medical interest. And this is sort of hand waving, so no equations in there, but what are the particular types of areas and problems that, you know, I think in the long and short term would be of interest to medical practitioners. So I think, firstly, I thought, you know, optimization of chemotherapy and other protocols, that's something Carl's, you know, I think been continuously doing at St. Jude's, and I think that, you know, is something that will still be of interest. So there, as I said, it's classical models and ODEs. There are control terms for treatment interventions, and of course there's always some performance index which measures the efficiency of therapy and normal tissue damage. In this area, it looks like control theory, you know, would be a good tool to tackle a lot of the problems with. Of course, the challenge in this area, I think, is to include more realistic models of drug action, cell proliferation, and heterogeneity. And you always need new parameter estimation methods. I think you'll always need that because you're not going to measure exactly the sort of data you want, and you have to sort of work with the data and see if you can work out other methods. Another area which I think is of growing importance is the development of resistance. You know, cancer cells, as everybody said, are genetically unstable, and they're subject to numerous genetic and phenotypic changes. And these changes really allow it to develop the qualities which allow it to escape from cytotoxic insults. Now, in this area, it would be useful to have biological parameters characterized mathematically. Resistance is often a function of frequency, intensity, duration of treatment, plus cell age. It would be nice to have more precise sort of parameters that you could measure. Cell population models, which I talked briefly about, this is a well-developed area in biomathematics. And if you look at modeling growth and differentiation of normal and tumor cells, what we need here is to integrate the newly described genetic and molecular mechanisms into models of proliferation, growth of tumors, and heterogeneity of tumors. You'd like to develop some sort of precise mathematical models similar to the type of stuff that's been developed for hematopoiesis and self-renewal of colon epithelium. This area is sort of, I always have, two points of view here, because I always think, as probably a lot of the Waterloo people have heard us saying many times, that, when you go to the genetic level, there's a whole slew of, it's a bit like a spaghetti junction, and you have pathways and interactions between genes, no clear pathway that you can identify, and neither are there single genetic or sequences genetic things that you can characterize as what causes this cancer. I mean, the sum of it causes it all. So, my point of view has always been that it's maybe more profitable to look at a continuum level and develop some sort of insights before you go to the genetic level, then to come down to the drug action again here, mechanisms of most anti-cancer drugs is really to target specific molecular targets. It aims at specific molecular targets which are associated with, say, cell growth, differentiation, and cell death. So we need models that are going to link drug concentration in tumors with molecular targets. Don't ask me how you do it, but I foresee that as an area which will be of huge interest. And drug delivery, here the diffusion and binding of drugs to macromolecules, porosity, diffusivity. We need mathematical models of how these processes affect drug delivery. The majority of human cancers, you could say probably over 80% of human cancers are solid tumors. And drug-induced apoptosis depends on drug delivery from the site of administration, residence time in the target sites, and effective drug concentration. So I think at a more fundamental level, the use of continuum mechanics to study microcirculation within tumors may well have implications for all of the above. Just to sort of conclude, I think, as a grad student or new researchers going into the area, I think it's a great area to get into, because I don't foresee, the solution to cancer being found in the next 40, 50 years, and with a sort of fundamental mathematical approach which links to therapies and clinical practice, I think, there's a lot of mileage and a lot of opportunities. Okay, thanks.